Thank you, Brian, for your lovely invitation. It was amazing. I haven't been back in Oxford for 20 years. It was like it's the opposite of culture shock. It's like culture splash or something. Guy was asking me for something catchy to introduce. There isn't anything about me. I don't have a personality. I'm a complete bore. But my profession is to help other people not bore. And so that's what I study. And I'm not a speechwriter or a public speaker, although I do both of those activities professionally. I call myself a story boffin. So I'm obsessed with stories in all genres and in all media. So I'm syncretic. I'm not really the deepest expert in any one thing. But I've been obsessed with this all my life. And then later in my career, I realized this is what I actually need to do. And so I'll start by saying this, maybe, that just to share some of the skeletal structure of how I think. I think that there are five story arts and five applied ones. Okay? So they go from poetry to theater or drama to fiction, which includes nonfiction, by the way. I mean, nonfiction is a complete oxymoron. There is nothing that's not shaped. So it's poetry, theater, fiction, and then we have, we have screenwriting, and then of course we have songwriting. Now, obviously songwriting is deeply connected, so you can't really separate songwriting from poetry and which started first. Song starts first, of course, because isn't Thespis the first actor, the first atom that breaks away from the chorus and becomes a character, the first voice? Because before that, it's all just singing and dancing. But nevertheless, so this is kind of cyclical. But these are the ones that you love, that you can't earn money with. This is actually what you are. So I'm a novelist now because I got out of the final tunnel, Tom, Dick, and Harry, and it was long enough and I could breathe. Okay, this is what I want to do, or what I thought I could get away with doing. So these are high risk. Three of them are kind of like private in the sense that you do it yourself mostly, and two of them are kind of a little bit more collaborative or competitive. You know, you do them sometimes in teams. The applied ones are where you realize you can turn a buck. So you've got the journalism and you've got the copywriting. I didn't even know what that was. I never heard that word when I was in school. I wish I had. Journalism, I've paid most of my bills in my life with this thing, whatever the hell it is. Journalism, copywriting, ghostwriting, which I kind of now do, although I never advertise. I don't know how these ghosts keep coming to me. Ghostwriting, speech writing. I wonder who does that for a living. And then finally, there is a weird one in Hollywood and other places called script doctoring.
Yes,
which is a very interesting one, where you just basically, if it doesn't work, you get the blame. And Will Goldman is probably the most famous script writer, doctor in the world. He passed away last year. So these are the ones where you earn your money. And these are the ones that you kind of, your spare time, you know, these are your hobbies, and this is your, I want you to remember this one above the line, because this is all going to be botified. This is on the way out. You are turning into a bot. So you'll be ChatGPT, DDF thing, whatever. And so the industrial decision to become a machine now has to be reversed. So you remain a speechwriter, but you have to become more and more creative and imaginative to stay ahead of those bots, because the bots are becoming more and more persuasive. So there's basically, my understanding is that there's kind of like two languages inside every language. And one of them is persuasive, and one of them is imaginative. So the imaginative form has to do, of course, with poetics, drama, storytelling. And the persuasive has to do with rhetoric and public discourse. And of course, you can't separate them because they're deeply embedded with each other. But they're kind of, the principles are different in both of them. This is when you have a captive audience and this is when you don't have a captive audience. So the captive audience is also disappearing, in fact, because they're in the room, but they're connected up to multiple devices and screens. Okay, so they're not here. Okay, so people have measured the attention span of audiences, and there was an infamous Microsoft survey in Canada about a decade ago that the human now has a lesser attention span than a goldfish. It's like 8 seconds. I think it's actually a lot less than 8 seconds online. Are you responsible for that? Yes. Okay?
Sure.
Because it's your job not to steal anybody's attention. It's your job to earn people's attention. And these people literally starve to death when they don't earn your attention.
Yeah.
These people are the professionals. These people are pretending. Okay? These people get paid off. These people die. When I was in Oxford 90 years ago, there was a young chap from Chicago who kept coming to me, and he wanted dozens of personal one-to-one seminars in Fillion's Wake, because I'm from Dublin and I can walk across one part of the city to the other without passing a pub, and I've had enough to drink. He just wanted to keep learning, feeling his way ad nauseum. And we go through it each, because there's 17 chapters in it, and we go right back to the start and do the whole thing all over again. Who is this person? He's the screenwriter and showrunner of Game of Thrones. And you think, wow, is this, you know, my wife will fly to London years later. Dan Weiss, Jim? Is that Dan?
What?
He's living in my house. The thing, you'd think that's a great success because it's one of the biggest television fictions of all time. It was a complete disaster most of the time. They spent $10 million on a pilot that was just flushed down the toilet, because that was how tough the competition is. Writing it is nothing. Getting the pilot done is nothing. Okay, so the successes here are absolute exceptions. And all I want to do today is, I want us to look at the survivors and what are they doing? What are they doing that they can survive? They're still alive. They made it. What did they do? Because I'm going to have to tune into that a little bit more. I don't want to starve to death, thank you. Yeah? But that's the toughest environment there is. They're the storytellers. I'm not the storyteller. Yeah? And I want to steal a few of their Phillips screwdrivers. That's really what I'm here to do. And so we can start by taking a look at some of the basic principles. Now, I don't mean that you're turning a speech into a story. I don't think a speech is a story, but a speech is related to a story, and it's using stories. Sometimes chief executives tell me, when I meet them, oh, I'm a storyteller too. I hate that shit.
Yeah.
You're not a storyteller too. Uh-oh. You are an anecdotalist. You may be a very good anecdotalist, but you are not a storyteller, okay? Story. The etymon, the true source and root. There's many different, you know, it's obviously related to witnessing and the word history. Now. But my favorite etymology of the word story is learning by asking questions. This is exactly what a storyteller does. A storyteller never answers questions. They just ask bigger, better questions than the storytellers that came before. That's all they do. Okay? You get a great writer like Samuel Beckett that says, oh, look, failure, disappointment, nobody's ever explored that. That's mine. Okay? And then they go in and then they flesh it out and then they make it their own little empire. So storyteller, your job as a storyteller is to ask bigger, better questions. And the classic one that I ask myself, if people give me a job to do, it's kind of like a template. What customer dilemma does this organization exist to resolve? What customer dilemma does this organization exist to resolve? You can't answer that question with a target, or we want to be number one and two in this market. You can't answer that. You have to think from another person's perspective. So storytelling is humbling because you must have no ego, and storytelling allows us to invade and pervade other people's madnesses.
somebody says, what's the definition of comedy? It's strategy that happens over people. So if you go back to ancient Greece, you've got the agora, and you've got the theatron, you've got the marketplace where public discourse is exercised rhetorically, and then you've got the theater, where you have the theater of Dionysus, of course, in Athens, where you have the gel factory. And you go there to gel, okay? So what Aristotle calls the cathartic expelling of pity and terror, but that's not the only emotion. What happens in a theater originally is that people bond over their pain. And that's basically the kind of the essential function of all marketplaces. People don't want to buy products or services or solutions. They want to bond with organizations and brands that feel their pain deeper than other people. And so what I found very interesting in my research was Greek cities were always designed. There was nothing accidental about them. And they never started with the temple, which you think, okay, maybe that's obvious. They never started with the marketplace. I mean, you think they're basic functions of a civilization. The very first building they designed and built was the theater. Why? Because that's where you gelled the tribe together. And when you had a bonded team, you can do anything. You can build the rest of the city. If you don't have that, you know, you're not in business as a civilization. So I am not an expert in rhetoric, but there is a kind of a sequence in a rhetorical argument where you display or share your authority or expertise to some degree, where you develop an argument, and if you're clever, you'll start with a counter-argument, and you weigh those up, you'll try to bring in the naysayers, and then you'll finish a little bit more empathically with some emotional evidence or proof for making it human. And that's the flow, and that's great. It's timeless, it's proven, and it no longer works. Because of Steve Jobs. When the smartphone was released in 2006, that was all over. With mobile screen, everyone's got a theatron in their pocket, and you've got very stiff competition now. Okay, your speakers have. And so that's for captive audiences. And this is the dramatic sequence where you substitute or supplement the expertise of your prime minister with their empathy, okay? Or you foreground their logical argument with a little suspense, and you prequel their pathos with a little surprise. And this sequence, empathy, suspense, surprise, is universal. And it's actually taking over the world. It's why people no longer watch the news. Because the news doesn't follow this sequence, and the news follows a rhetorical sequence, and there's no audience for that. It's why original content has exploded all over the place, and it explains the rise of new brands like Netflix and long-form television. So it's not, the question is, the fact of the matter is, we don't have less attention than before. That's not true. We have all or nothing. No one has a little bit of attention anymore. And if you want to speak for 100 hours, we will listen and be traumatized when it comes to an end, if it's in story form. Because that's exactly what happened at the end of Game of Thrones. People were traumatized because it was over. What was that, like 96 hours? Because they have all the time in the world, or none, absolutely none. Okay? And so it's become a complete dilemma. Now, when I say, my personal recipe is empathy, suspense, surprise. In my mind, this is actually identical to descent, initiation, return, which is the kind of meta-sequence used by Joseph Campbell in The Hero's Journey, which is such a template for most entertainments and a lot of the arts. And of course, the monomyth is the neologism from James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. If you want to know who's responsible for all this, it's James Joyce and this idea that there's one story that fits them all. And many people hate this, because it's reductionist or simplistic. It's not simplistic. People hate Joseph Campbell now as well, because it should be a collective hero's journey, not just one person's hero's journey. Joseph Campbell never said that it's not a collective hero's journey. Everyone is the hero of their own lives. It's not one white male person. Yeah? Everyone is the protagonist of their own tragedy. And in Greek terms, in Greek dramaturgical terms, it's exactly the same sequence. Harmatia is the tragic flaw. Yeah? Yes, the president tells lies. Everyone is deeply flawed, okay? And that's what connects them, okay? Peripeteia is what is revealed. It's that whole idea of the you're building up suspense because you want to know something, so information is withheld, which is why PowerPoint sucks, because information is not withheld. You're actually given a contents list. You can get up and walk out the door. And catharsis, of course, which is the release. So the tricky one is understanding, what does descent mean? Descent means shit happened and keeps on happening in unexpected ways. Okay, so that's what they call in Hollywood terms the compelling event. Okay, so something's gone wrong, and that's just the law of reality, and it'll happen every day. And the problem we mentioned in the workshop yesterday, I have to recommend, I'm sorry I couldn't attend all the other ones, but Larry's workshop was really brilliant. And he talked about Obama and how he flipped the recipe rhetorically. And I think the problem with what turned out there was that he did the descent bit really well, because he understood the dangers of division. But Obama never got to return. He never got to the return phase. He never came back with the golden fleece. That's the problem. It was a hero's journey that stopped midway. What does initiation mean? Initiation is the heart of the hero's journey. And initiation means the new knowledge that we now have to embed because of this shit keeps happening. Okay, so it's usually something to do with the behavioral prompt that we'd like to nudge people, as we did in the lockdowns. I hate nudging. I hate influence, because that whole idea that you can influence anybody is fascism. Everyone is their own storyteller. And storytelling is a sign of democracy, of you interpreting it yourself. You don't want people to tell you the answers or to nudge you. You want people to point out the interesting directions. So what does return mean? Return means when you bring the knowledge that you've learned back to your tribe, okay? So you're handing on. So it's the whole idea of your life falling apart, your country falling apart, what the hell is going on, WTF, something is found, or, I mean, I had a conversation in St. John's the other evening. Who was the greatest Briton that ever lived? In my book, it was Dowdy. Was he Scottish? The man that put the Spitfires together in time against much, much internal resistance. He wasn't even rewarded or recognized. Sure, he wasn't by his own side. But Dowdy knew the dangers that faced this country in 1940. And he actually saved the entire country against massive opposition in Berlin by having enough Spitfires left and salvaged from France to actually repel the Luftwaffe. So it's a classic example. Dowding is the embodiment of initiation. What we need here are the Spitfires right now, lots of them, enough of them to reverse what's happening. And so this is biological. This has nothing to do with words or feelings. This is your hormones. You're not watching Game of Thrones. Your hormones are watching Game of Thrones. And they're using your body as an electronic platform. They don't care about you. They're the ones that zap the channels because they're bored. They make you zap that channel. And the biggest one that's, it's not that these are evenly distributed, but all public organizations and certainly every government on the planet has a massive oxytocin deficit. They have an oxytocin deficit, yeah, that they are often the last to know about. And it's your job as speechwriters to pour the oxytocin back into the empty tank. I mean, different writers specialize in different versions of this. The Disney Empire, of course, specializes in double chocolate chip dopamine. Stephen King specializes in the intravenous injection of cortisol. But they're always in that sequence. Never perhaps in the same quantities, but they're always in that sequence because you're not oxytocin, you're not online, you have no audience, there is no attention. Okay? And this is the forgetfulness curve of Hermann Ebbinghaus, a German sociologist. Now, this was studied before cinema, so it's late 19th century. There are newspapers, there's no radio, there's no cinema, there's no television, there's certainly no smartphones. And almost everything that people are exposed to is immediately forgotten. Okay, so even if you make it, it's useless. And this knowledge, this humility, and this awareness is very, very important. Because the goalposts and the KPIs are not just what are my audience feeling today, it's how many minutes do I deserve from this audience? And how long do I want them to remember what I'm saying? Okay, so you work within those goalposts, earning their attention and extending their memory. And the memory is more important at the end of the day than gaining their attention. This is the classic three-act structure. It's referred to in dramaturgy as Gustav Freytag's triangle. He was a German dramatist and theorist in the 19th century, mid-19th century. And it's basically rising action, climax, falling action. I don't like this because it's too static. That's not the shape of my life. But life is full of these tiny little incidences. And what are they all about? So I have two personal definitions of what a story is. Learning by inquiry is the etymology, but I have two personal definitions. The first one is, storytelling is the creation of expectation followed by surprise. You never give people what they want, but you must make them want something. And that's the rhythm. You know the way when people tell jokes and on the Monday afternoon he goes into the pub and dot, 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 and then on Tuesday morning, there's always a bit in the middle of a joke that's just a boring repetition. There's no need for it. But it's definitely structurally important because otherwise you wouldn't develop the expectation to reverse at the end. So crisis is the essence of drama, the story. Crisis is the Greek word for decision. A crisis is not a bad thing. Crisis just means that you can no longer postpone the decision. Politics is the art of taking the decisions now instead of later, because you can no longer postpone them. That's all it's about. And when nobody listens and nobody wants to take the decision, it's because they don't understand the pressures surrounding the decision. So my second definition of story is that story, it's choices under pressure. That's the smallest snapshot. What is the crystal snowflake of what I'm doing here? I'm dealing with choices under pressure. And when I have no customer, or no audience, or no attention, it's because I don't have enough pressure in what I'm talking about. The publisher hasn't bought my manuscript because there's not enough pressure in it. There's not enough air pressure in the tires. Okay? So the greater the pressure that the choice is under, the bigger your audience. And unfortunately, after the pandemics, we're all cortisoled out. I mean, you can't do that forever. Do you know what I mean? That's why it stopped and let us breathe a little bit. Now, the hero's journey, which is the big version. So you get the small little Freytag pyramid for a single scene, and then you get the big scale. This is the design format that all those long-form TV shows are based on. The classic example of this is Star Wars, the whole Star Wars empire, which of course is largely inspired on the friendship between George Lucas and George Campbell. And so these are mythological structures. And basically, the difference between the ordinary world and the special world is, you know, the status quo of what you know, and the special world is the unknown. So you move or you push from the known to the unknown. And the problem, of course, if I were to update the hero's journey, I'd remove the ordinary world because it just doesn't exist anymore. And it's never coming back. And we're just left in this special unknown thing that's going on and on, okay? You know the last part of 2001, A Space Odyssey? It's really amazing because Kubrick was such a genius. Halfway through this film, he just ditches the narrative and it's like Jupiter and beyond. And to me, that's just awesome. It's like Hal is dead, he's just disabled, that evil machine. And where's he going? And even the mythology of that, because Jupiter is the idea of going beyond the father figure, yeah, your elders. You're traveling into deep space. No one's ever done this before, what you're doing. They don't know what you're talking about. You can't ask anybody older about it. And this is the last slide that I'd like to read. This is a diagram that was made personally by Walt in 1957. It is literally worth billions and billions of dollars because Disney, which is the world's greatest storytelling empire, I'm a fan in any way, but Disney has built a transmedia empire on this idea. So the last idea that I'd like to leave you with is the concept that your speech is not alone and that increasingly you'll be required to be more imaginative and more inventive as you speech write for yourself or other people, but also you'll be asked to do other things, okay? So maybe what will happen more in the future is at the center of your empire will be the speeches, and then there will be other things that are related to them, like the social posts or the novel, or you'll make short little movie clips that are based, they're not from the speech, not recordings, they're outtakes. And what happens is, you're no longer just a genre writer, you're no longer specialized in one medium, okay? And there'll be things that need to be mapped out and coordinated. This is called transmedia storytelling. The best book about this is by a young gentleman whose name sounds backwards, Houston Howard. He sounds as if he should be called Howard. He's a lovely media lawyer I know from Kentucky. Very smart man. He doesn't describe the insides of story structure, but he really understands the strategy of platforms and marketplaces. And he's written a book, which is, there's a new edition relatively recently called You're Gonna Need a Bigger Story. Great, very important book. To me, it's the most important book on story this century, because it's not actually about storytelling. It's about being a storyteller with all of these media and all of these platforms as not just opportunities, but pressing demands, okay? And how am I going to strategize this if the speech is the tactic, where is the strategy, okay? So that's basically it, folks. I'll throw the floor open.